Hello and welcome to the World Soccer Talk podcast, your weekly dose of talking about watching soccer on TV, online and apps. Coming up on episode 55, we discuss what the elements are for a perfect soccer telecast, exciting news for Arsenal and Chelsea fans, our opinions about the festive fixtures on NBC Sports, as well as the latest soccer TV news. Plus, we have a ton of letters from you, the listeners, in our mailbag section to our last podcast talking about promotion relegation. So, welcome to our first episode of 2018. My name is Christopher Harris, a.k.a. The Gaffer, and I'm joined today by Kartik Krishnaya. Kartik, how's 2018 been so far for you?
So far, so good. Just a few days. I've come down with a bit of a cold, but I think it's what's going around in the season.
Yeah, definitely. And us here in Florida, we're suffering from the cold weather. This is extremely uncommon temperatures. So this morning it was in the upper 30s, which is very, very rare for us down here. So we're getting a little bit of the medicine that the rest of most of the rest of America gets all the time. But it's taken some adjusting. So yes. this podcast is now entering, Kartik, its 11th year of being in existence. It's gone through many different forms over the years. For those who haven't had a chance to listen to us before, the latest incarnation of this podcast focuses on watching soccer on television, online, and apps, talking about the commentators, talking about the production, the analysis, where to find matches, as well as all of the latest streaming news as more and more streaming companies and options come online, it becomes pretty complicated. So we're trying to answer those questions, give you the news, and then also talk about what we've been watching. So we'll kick off there, what we've been watching. And Kartik, just for a change, I'll start off here in terms of some of the things I've been watching, and I'll have you jump in. But we've survived. For me, the most enjoyable time of the year watching soccer is over the festive period. And it's a hard slog for fans watching the games on television. It's a lot of work. I enjoy it, of course, but it's intense. And it goes from about December 22nd all the way through till today, January 4th. And it kicked off, Kartik. We haven't had a chance to talk about any of this stuff, so I don't know what you saw and what you didn't see, but it kicked off with that Arsenal-Liverpool match on December 22nd, that 3-3 draw, but not a good advertisement for defences, but what a match.
Yeah, I suppose what a match in terms of the scoring and the chances. But again, I thought it was a terrible advertisement for the level of the Premier League. I think so often I've found this mentality, this kind of herd mentality among Premier League fans based in the United States, where any sort of critique of the league is met with the sort of defenses you get from SEC football fans and college football. It's a very similar mentality. So after this game, I pointed out that I felt like for two teams that aspire to be in the top four, two teams that are regularly in European competition, two of the bigger clubs on the continent or in the European game, obviously they're in Great Britain, so they're not on the continent physically, that this was a really poor standard of football from a defensive standpoint. And then, you know, that's meant always by some shots at the Bundesliga, some shots at La Liga, and the classic defense mechanisms. Yeah, I would say it was an entertaining match, but just pointed out, and as the ESPN FC crew pointed out later that day on in breaking down this game, it's the kind of basic defensive errors that you shouldn't see at this level. It's not that, oh my goodness, it was a fantastic attacking move, that's why you saw the mistakes you saw. So for me, a disappointing start to the festive period, and also I think another indication that Liverpool is missing a little something, because there are every match they play, with one or two exceptions this season, they've been well on top. If their chance creation has been far greater than the opposition, whether they're playing against Arsenal or Chelsea, or whether they're playing against West Brom or Swansea, it seems regularly they are creating more chances than their opposition. And in too many matches, they're not coming away with 3 points.
Yeah, for me, I go the other extreme, which is I love the game. It was an entertaining match, fantastic football. But it's one of those things, because if you have the kind of a really pure style of football that, I mean, defensively sound, very strong in the back, what you end up with is kind of the Serie A of old, where it might be a 1-0 victory for in a game that's very defensively, very very sound, but in some ways very boring. So I guess it's those imperfections in the Premier League that does make it exciting. And that culminated yesterday, Kartik, in that another entertaining match for me, at least, the 2-2 draw between Arsenal and Chelsea, and another kind of end-to-end thrilling match, just really exciting to watch. Again, defensive mistakes, but I mean, that's the thing about the Premier League, especially this time of the season. You get some games that are really, really kind of scrappy, a lot of scrappy games, and then you have a lot of other ones that are kind of high-scoring games. And as we know from previous, you know, Boxing Days and New Year's Day matches in the Premier League, there are usually lots of goals happening and some really crazy score lines. We didn't get many crazy score lines, but we did get, to me at least, a lot of entertaining matches.
Yeah, for me, one thing that was disappointing about this whole period was that there has been, in the era of more and more emphasis on exclusive windows for matches on television, a de-emphasis of the importance of Boxing Day matches, right? So essentially, you're seeing the best matches that you would want to watch on what is always billed or traditionally has been the height of the football calendar in English football, in particular, pulled to December 27th, pulled to December 22nd, pulled to January 3rd, which was Chelsea-Arsenal. And the actual Boxing Day fixtures this year were probably the worst I can remember in terms of just compelling storylines and matches you want to watch. Yet they were sandwiched during the course of the week by matches you wanted to watch that were pulled into exclusive windows when nothing else was going on. No other matches were taking place.
That's a good point. That's a good point, actually. Yeah, because like actually it has been drawn out. And of course, today, by the time most of those listeners hear this podcast, the Spurs-West Ham game will be over. But it is really stretched out. But to me, it's entertaining. It's almost every single day there's a match on. I mean, some are better than others, but there's always something interesting to watch. And speaking of Serie A, I mean, Serie A this year has decided not to go with the winter break. But I don't hear a lot of people talking about Serie A matches, even though they've been being played over this festive period also.
Yeah, I think it was a little bit of a strange adjustment for fans of Italian football. The Coppa Italia, two of the quarterfinal games took place December 27th, and then two of them took place yesterday, January 3rd. It was odd because they forced this extra round of fixtures into the calendar, and I think it was something that people weren't prepared for. That having been said, Serie A is the one big European league with a real title race ongoing, and it has prompted me to check out the games. If I don't watch Juventus, it's one thing, because Juventus is still very there's nothing wrong with watching Juve, but Napoli is one of the best teams to watch in Europe, and a lot of us are tired of the same teams winning titles over and over again in these continental leagues. So I'm very much, for the next 4 months, probably a Napoli supporter.
Yeah, and that's something we've talked about or teased. We should probably visit it at some point, Kartik, in the future, in terms of talking about Serie A and just focusing on that in terms of television and how it's kind of the rise and fall of Serie A on television in the United States. But that's the thing. I mean, with beIN Sports over this Christmas period, beIN Sports is playing the Serie A matches and the Coppa Italia. Actually, Coppa Italia is on Gold TV, but the Serie A matches have been on beIN Sports and beIN Sports en Espanol. But there's been very little promotion or coverage of it, and it seems to be just kind of lost on.
This is the problem with beIN: when La Liga and PSG are off, they're off.
It seems that way, but
I mean, I that might be taken as a very, people might be sensitive about that critique, but I feel like the emphasis on Serie A isn't there. I would like Serie A to find a better television partner in the United States, because I think it's always going to be third fiddle. So La Liga, for obvious reasons, should be number one on that network. Okay, I'm not gonna dispute that, and it's arguably the best league in the world, and it's got the two most visible football clubs in the world, but I think because of the relationship between beIN Sports and PSG and via Qatar, there is a emphasis on Liga 1 that probably should be placed on Serie A instead if editorial were completely independent. And I'd love to hear from beIN Sport about this. But they have not covered Serie A to my satisfaction for a number of years, if I'm going to be quite frank about it.
Yeah.
I'm far more interested in what goes on in Serie A than I am in what goes on in Liga 1. Just because I think it's a higher level league. It's a more compelling league from my perspective. And I think from the perspective probably of more people in this country than the contrary view, which is in favor of Liga 1.
Yeah, it's just challenging to try to fit everything in. I mean, I do get to watch a Serie A match now and again, but yeah, we'll save that one for another episode. I think that'll be a good topic we can dive into. So we're not going to go through every single match we watched over this festive period. I mean, it's a long list. I took a vacation for a week and was able to watch some of the games on a cruise, but still watched a ton of football. But two things that popped out at me, Kartik, were This Is Football. And this was the series, or documentary series, the first episode that was released, hosted by Joe Scarborough. And the first episode was focused on the Manchester Derby. And I found this program really interesting, Kartik. For anyone who missed it, definitely go back. It's probably on the NBC Sports app. You can probably watch it on demand. But this was a really, I was going to say a deep dive. It wasn't completely a deep dive, but it was a look at the culture around football. And in this case, around Manchester, as far as everything from the music to what it's like living in Manchester and how it's multiracial and how you have these two clubs. I mean, one on the outskirts of Manchester and one inside Manchester, and just kind of the history and the passion and interviews with some of the former players. What did you think of this one, Kartik? I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed This Is Football, and thought Joe Scarborough did a wonderful job, and give him a lot of credit because he's a high level guy. If you follow American politics, he's a guy that I didn't expect to get down in the weeds and do the kind of work he did. There's just the general work to go in and solicit these interviews, go to training, interview youth coaches, interview bar owners, that sort of thing. We've seen Roger Bennett do these things with NBC. My criticism of Roger Bennett would be that he's created such a character image of himself as a comedian that when he tries to be serious, you don't take him as seriously. So I think these sorts of programs Scarborough is a better host for. The thing that I want to impress on a lot of people listening is that there is a derby aspect. There is a rivalry between Manchester United and Manchester City. There's no question about that. But as you heard the bar owner, who's a United supporter, say towards the end of the show, he hates City, he hates Liverpool, but he hates Leeds more. And there has been, in the history, there was some discussion in the 1980s on the program. In the history of football hooliganism, Chris, you would see Cardiff supporters fight Leeds supporters. You'd see West Ham fight Chelsea, Tottenham fight Arsenal, Tottenham fight West Ham. You have never seen Liverpool and Everton fans, or very rarely, Liverpool and Everton fans or Manchester United and Manchester City fans turn on one another. There is a sense of purpose and grit and respect within the city, even the two football clubs and their supporters hate each other, to where they wouldn't turn to that sort of behavior toward one another. And even though Scarborough didn't mention that directly, the whole 1 hour, it's actually more like 50 minutes, the program, just reminded me of that there is a common spirit and a common bond among Mancunians, even though they're divided between red and blue in terms of their football. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was pleasantly surprised by this show. It actually made me feel proud to be a soccer fan. It embraced the passion and culture of what it's like to be a fan of the sport, and didn't do it in a condescending way. And it just made me feel good. It just made me feel part of this whole experience. And I have a feeling that's kind of what one of the intentions was in terms of like loyalty, just trying to encourage. I mean, all of us are soccer fans of all different clubs. I mean, some of us, like myself included, have nothing to do with Manchester. You do, Kartik, of course, have been a City supporter. But it just meant it made me feel good. It made me feel proud of being a soccer fan, but also enlightened me in terms of some of the things that we're talking about. I just thought it was really, really well done. The only negative, Kartik, to me is that oftentimes with NBC Sports, with kind of when they have a series, is I don't know when to expect the next episode. I know that it's going to be a few more coming out, but there's not that consistency. And I'm sure all of us who watch the Premier League on NBC Sports, once it comes up, then there'll be some promos and stuff like that. So we'll find out. But it's always one of those things that I just don't know when to expect it. So, and that's from myself being a reporter and getting press releases and emails from NBC Sports whenever things are coming up.
They even played, by the way, during this festive period, the Noisy Neighbors Premier League download was re-aired, which I didn't expect or didn't know it was going to be. I happened to stumble upon it on the program guide and DVR'd it, but that's a Premier League download from a year ago that they decided to re-air, but no notification, had no idea that was coming on.
And then, so the other thing I watched this, which is on the same day, actually, I think it was on Boxing Day or around about then, was the documentary called The Lane. And this was one that was produced by Tottenham Hotspur, but NBC Sports showed the entire documentary. Going into it, Kartik, my expectations was that this is going to be a Tottenham Hotspur puff piece and a very kind of, rah-rah Tottenham Hotspur and very, very kind of not much into the history and just focusing on just the changeover from the old White Hart Lane and moving over everything over to and building the new White Hart Lane. What we got was something I didn't expect. It was a very well-produced documentary that wasn't rah-rah. It was really a combination, almost a history of Tottenham Hotspur. A lot of archival footage, a lot of excellent interviews with former players and former coaches and staff, even some of the fans and some of the people inside Tottenham Hotspur. And it was really, to me, more of a documentary of the history of Spurs, including interviews with Jurgen Klinsmann, Jermaine Defoe, Glenn Hoddle, Harry Kane, Ledley King. I mean, you go down the list, Ricky Villa, Ozzy Ardiles. It was really, really, it pulled me in. And again, I'm not a Tottenham Hotspur fan by any means, but I really enjoyed this one too.
Oh yeah, it was so well done, and it was so, I think, humble in its. It served as a bit of an official history of the club, or at least the official history of the club at home at White Hart Lane. But it also, I think, showed Tottenham Hotspur warts and all, and was really thrilled to see Jimmy Greaves. Two things: that Jimmy Greaves being wheeled back out there, and it's a shame to see the kind of health he's in, but one of just the great players, magical players in the history of English football, and obviously maybe at the very top of the list of Tottenham Hotspur footballers. Great to see Ossie Ardiles and Ricky Villa talk about their exploits, even though as a Man City fan, I've heard obviously the other side of the 1981 FA Cup final replay where Ricky Villa scored that magical goal, one of the most magical goals in the history of Tottenham Hotspur, but a goal that a lot of Manchester City supporters blame for the club's decline over the next 20 years, which directly emanated from that FA Cup final replay. And then I thought the most touching part was the Fab Luamba part. We all remember that game very well. Some of us, I think, Chris, you included, myself for sure, were watching that game live on television here in the States when Fabrice Muamba's heart gave out on the White Hart Lane pitch. And it was, I thought it was so appropriate and really surprising that an official Spurs documentary devoted so much time to that moment and to what everybody felt that day. That was tremendous.
Yeah, it was really emotional. It really pulled you back into that moment when actually the build up to the incident, but also interviews with some of the fans that were in the stadium, and then having Fabrice Muamba talking about what happened and kind of what happened afterwards. Man, wow! I mean, that's a moment that I think anyone that watched that game will never forget it, and such a heartwarming and inspirational story. And that was just one example in this documentary. Again, I'm sure it's available on NBC Sports app on demand. But if you missed it, watch it because it was absolutely incredible. So a couple of things more, Kartik, in terms of what I've been watching this past month, really. I did mention I went away on vacation for a week. I went on a cruise in the Caribbean, which was great, lovely. But what happens oftentimes is on these cruises, they have a channel, a network called Sport 24. And the only reason I mention it is because most of the programming they have available is almost everything from Premier League productions. So whenever, this is my best opportunity every couple of years or so when I go on a cruise to see what Premier League productions are doing. A lot of the programming that we don't see. So we see some of it through NBC Sports Gold, like the fantasy Premier League show and Premier League news. But that's probably maybe about 10% of what they produce. But Kartik, and again, we haven't had a chance to talk about this, but Kartik, but I was just like blown away by the level of tactical analysis. And you had Owen Hargreaves, you had Phil Neville, you had I'm trying to think who else was on there, but you had some really, really excellent tactical minds just pulling apart games. So one of the games I watched was Everton Swansea. And this one, actually, they went back and looked at Manchester City from that weekend, and were just looking play by play, just all the different things that Man City was doing, and just lauding. I mean, just how fantastic this team is to watch, but doing it in such a way with the tactical analysis on the TV screens that was just mind blowing. It's really top level stuff. And hopefully NBC Sports will find a way to bring in some of this programming in the future. Maybe if they continue NBC Sports Gold next season, or if they have ways. I mean, they can use this content if they want to. But I was just amazed, and especially Owen Hargreaves, just doing an excellent job, and Phil Neville too. Now, a couple of other things, Kartik. The Everton-Man United match, they had the pitchside studio for with Arlo and Lee Dixon there. But I'm not sure if you caught this, but the post-match interviews they did were with Paul Pogba, which was huge, really enlightening too. I think one of the questions that came from Robbie Musto from the studio was to ask Pogba, in terms of his preferred position, does he prefer to play closer to the strikers as more of an attacking midfielder, or does he prefer to kind of drop back and help out as more of a defensive midfielder? That was enlightening. Then you had an interview with Sam Allardyce, which is always entertaining. Jordan Pickford was there too with an interview with the goalkeeper. But again, just a stellar job from NBC Sports. Not just this match, but the entire festive period. But yeah, just another example of how they're leading the line in terms of soccer coverage in the United States.
Yeah, I want to single out Arlo White during this festive period. I thought he was really on point and really good. He did a number of games. We know, obviously, because the lack of availability, it appears, of Steve Bauer, because anytime I watch something that something soccer related, Steve Bauer pops up on my screen, right? He's working so many different places. He's not available for NBC Sports on site at a lot of these matches anymore. And then you've got obviously Derek Ray, who is now filling the old Steve Bauer role in a way, but is based in the United States, right? It's not based in the UK, so they fly him over occasionally for games, but generally is based in the United States. I think Arlo White brought a consistent level to, if I count correctly, he did 5 or 6 matches during the festive period. And I think he was very, very on point and very well prepared. There was no off day for him. So I want to single him out because I know he's coming for a lot of criticism from fans and even on the show from us, but he was very good this 2-week period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, for me mostly, I mean, this entire month I've been watching mostly Premier League football, which is just a good example of how NBC Sports, it gives them a huge advantage, also gives the Premier League a huge advantage in terms of really monopolizing this time of the year where people do have a lot more time to watch games because, I mean, they're off work or they're spending time with their families. There's disadvantages to this, of course, for the national team and to the players, but from an entertainment perspective and from a TV perspective, to me, it's really perfect time. So, what about you, Kartik? Anything else that you watched that you want to mention? Anything that's maybe non-Premier League related?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose obviously the ESPN FC show not running right through this festive period, and they've done a fantastic job, and they've kept a lot of attention on some of the other non-Premier League topics, but it's been mostly Premier League, as you would expect. I thought Derek Ray and Robbie Earle did well in the 2 days in the studio that they had to fly solo, the two of them. One of the days they had a one-hour goal zone and were able to get enough content and do something that was, I thought, kind of interesting that I haven't seen on NBC before. With the additional time they had and down a pundit, they went ahead and played a little game of 60 seconds previewing the next set of fixtures, where Derek Ray would throw Robbie Earle a question. He had 60 seconds to answer it about an upcoming fixture. So a little bit of a Premier League preview there, which we don't get often from NBC Sports. So that was an interesting takeaway. I think also I wanted to mention before the Bundesliga break or the German football break, Adrian Healy and Craig Burley on the ESPN2 broadcast of Bayern and Borussia Dortmund from the German Cup was a very, very good, tight broadcast by ESPN and thought they did quite well on it. And it's interesting. It seems ESPN has this this German Cup in reserve as a throwaway property they put on ESPN3, that every season at some point Bayern comes up against Borussia Dortmund and they move it to the regular network. Because I think this is four or five straight years they've ended up playing in the German Cup, which is ironic. It makes you wonder if the draw is a little bit fixed because those are the two highest profile clubs in German football. No doubt about that. And they get an extra round of international attention on German football if those two play in the cup.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny because it always seems that the Real Madrid and Borussia Dortmund always match up in the Champions League almost every year.
Oh, yeah, that's another one, right, yeah.
yeah, I think it's just a coincidence. But all right, let's move on, Kartik. Are we looking at TV streaming news, and what's the first topic?
Well, I guess the first thing of interest to our listeners is, speaking of what I just talked about, the Arsenal-Chelsea game has been moved, at least the first leg, of the League Cup semifinals. Remember, it's over two legs on January 10th, has been moved to be shown live on ESPN2 in the United States, which is something that I think many of our listeners and fans of the Premier League have been asking about seemingly endlessly for the last 6 months since BAMTech and ESPN3 acquired the rights to the championship and the League Cup.
Yeah, definitely. And right as of press time right now, Manchester City against Bristol City, the other semi-final will be on ESPN3. But it's still possible it could be moved, but definitely the Chelsea-Arsenal game on Wednesday, January 10th, will be moved to ESPN2. So moving on to other news, this past year, 2017, Univision Deportes earned the highest share of soccer viewing in the United States among 29 networks broadcasting live soccer, claiming over 40% of all viewing across all of the networks of Univision. Plus, Univision Deportes led the industry by broadcasting 19 out of the top 20 rated club soccer matches in 2017, regardless of language. And just goes to show, really, most of these games would have been Liga MX games, and just how continuous, popular they are year by year, and how that really helps Univision and Univision Deportes in terms of getting these large numbers in the TV ratings war.
Yeah, a significant clause in the Premier League's tender for bid suggests it's already thinking of new media and its future. And by the way, the current set of television contracts outside the United States, we had a worse 6-year deal, but the 3-year deals all expire at the end of next season. The league said its new rights packages would be available on a, quote, technology-neutral basis, meaning it's open to showing matches exclusively online and widely seen as an invitation to digital giants to enter the fray. This was in the Financial Times, by the way.
Yeah, so this is a big one, because this means that it's opening the doors for companies such as Amazon or Facebook or YouTube or whoever. And there's many out there that where they could actually acquire the rights to the Premier League in the UK, perhaps at first, and have it available through streaming only, and that would be perfectly. Legal, but it would work. in the past, the deals would have been that you would have had to have a TV, as a TV company, you'd have to have a TV, the game's on television, and you could have it on streaming too. But this opens the door for a streaming company to say, okay, we're acquiring the rights to all the Premier League, and we're just going to show it on, say, Amazon Prime, as one example. Whether or not this will happen, we'll have to wait and see. But just show in terms of how the industry is changing and how we could be seeing, you know, in the next maybe 2 or 3 years, perhaps, in the UK. Of course, Sky Sports and BT Sports will be wanting to keep those on television, but it's opening the door, and it's going to happen at some point. But.
And I think that this is also something that's going to continue to threaten the traditional 3 p.m. kickoffs times that we have for games in England. And so fans in the UK themselves may not be very happy about this, although it may give them more exposure to games on media via the media, because as many of our listeners know, you can't watch any of those games live, and you're waiting for Match of the Day to come on later in the day to actually see any clips from them.
Yeah, yeah. The blackout in the UK is their local time, from 2:45 to 5:15. There's no matches available on television at all, or streaming. And those would include matches from La Liga or any other leagues around the world. So, yeah.
Correct. Right.
See what happens there. All right, Kartik, moving on. SportsTVRatings.com has published the most updated number of subscribers for the leading sports networks in the United States that broadcast soccer. And we're not going to go through every single one of them, but there are some enlightening numbers. So here are the networks with the most viewers from most to least. Number one, which is actually, to me, very surprising, Kartik, TNT, 90 million viewers. So this one, I mean, TNT is a new one to, well, recently the club soccer space. Starting in the 2018 summer, they will be broadcasting the Champions League to us in the United States. We know that it's not going to be every single game. There's going to be only select games available through TNT. But 90 million, which is greater than any other sports network in the United States, Kartik.
Yeah, I'm not that surprised by that. There's a lot on TNT that isn't sports. It's a general variety channel. Obviously, their sports anchor for years has been the NBA. More recently, have acquired some of the NCAA basketball tournament, now the UEFA Champions League. They cater to kind of general audiences, and I think it's one of the basic cable packages. Even if you go to a hotel and you've got 10 channels on your TV, you get TNT. So it doesn't surprise me that much, but it is significant in that there are actually more subscribers than any ESPN or NBC or Fox channel that specializes in sports.
So speaking of ESPN, ESPN's got 86 million. ESPN2 has 86 million also. And then True TV, which will be another network that will show some of the Champions League games, that one is going to be 86 million, which again is massive numbers for Turner in terms of broadcasting the Champions League. Then you've got NBCSN at 84 million, FS1, 84 million, FS2 is 52 million, which is interesting too, because there's so many people that complain that they don't get FS2. Univision Deportes, 44 million, Universo, 41 million, BN Sports, 22 million, Fox Deportes, 21 million, and then BN Sports in Espanol, and that's 18 million.
Wow. So the FS2 number is not as low as you'd think it is, given the number of people who complain. I guess most of the people who don't get it who are soccer fans complain to us. So I thought that number was somewhere 30 or 35 million, honestly, based on the complaints.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've always joked kind of half-heartedly that FS2 is almost like the last bastion of soccer coverage, because those numbers on FS2 usually for whether it's Bundesliga games or, you know, FA Cup games are sometimes in the tens of thousands, just small numbers.
Well, I found actually from talking to folks that the ratings in general for anything on FS2 are very poor, including college basketball. And the few times, it's why they try and avoid showing any college football on FS2. That it's, even if people have the channel, they may not realize they have the channel. which shows itself in the numbers. Because if you consider it's in 52 million homes and FS1's in 84 million homes, that's in about 65% of the homes that FS1 is in. But yet the ratings drop-offs for any given event is more than – it's not 65% of one. If the FS1 rating is A1, it's not 0.65 for FS2. It tends to be like somewhere in the neighborhood of 0.3. So it's just a kind of the purgatory for soccer coverage and everything.
Absolutely. All right, Kartik, one more item in the news before we move on.
Yeah, one of Telemundo's most important TV shows finished 2017 with its highest rated season ever. And it's the second consecutive year it ranks as the number one sports news and commentary show in Spanish language TV among adults from the ages of 18 to 49. Telemundo's nightly sports entertainment show, Titelas y Más, outperformed Univision's Contacto Deportivo, which is a show I'll say I was on once 8 years ago before the Confederations Cup final 2009 among adults 18 to 49 and total viewers. The show will continue to be a big part of Telemundo's programming in 2018, including around the World Cup games this summer. I'm quite stunned by this. This is great for Telemundo. Contacto Deportivo has been the gold standard in terms of Spanish language news, sports news coverage for many years, much like SportsCenter is in English. So congratulations for Telemundo.
Wait, Kartik, wait a second. You were on Contacto Deportivo? I didn't know this. What was this all about?
This was before the Confederations Cup final in 2000. Oh, you know what? I was not. I was on another Univision show the same day. That's right.
Okay. Wow. Wow, that's so impressive. But it was for the Strikers or for...
Yeah, it was Miami FC in those days, Miami but yeah.
Okay, all right. Okay. All right.
But yeah, it was the Strikers. I think that became the Strikers, not the current Miami FC. That's too much confusion for people. But so yeah, we'll say it was for the Strikers.
Okay. Okay, Kartik, let's move on to TV ratings. So in terms of the last month, we're not going to go through every number. We have the TV ratings posted at worldsoccertalk.com that go into a lot more exhaustive detail. But some of the numbers that do jump out... NBC Sports, speaking of which, for the past 6 weeks have had a million viewers or more for Premier League games. So just a couple of the numbers that do jump out. They had 1.1 million for the Leicester-Man United match on NBC, which was on Saturday, December 23rd. That was on NBC and Telemundo. They just had just over a million for Man United against Southampton. That was on December 30th. That was on NBC and Universal. There's definitely a kind of a trail here, which is Manchester United. Manchester United is the most supported club among English-speaking fans in the United States. And whenever the Man United are doing well or fighting for a Champions League spot, those numbers do reflect that. And NBC definitely kind of benefits from that. Some of the other numbers that do jump out, Kartik, of course, El Clásico, which was Real Madrid-Barcelona on beIN Sports and beIN Sports in Espanol. That was on December 22nd. This one had an early kickoff time. It was really set for Asia, so it'd be primetime Asia. But it was 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. Eastern time and had 845,000 viewers. What's your thinking about that one too, Kartik?
Yeah, that's a remarkable number given the start time. There are people who slept through the game. I know there are people that slept through the game that I've spoken to that said, oh my goodness, that was this morning, right? I thought it was this afternoon.
Right.
Because we're so used to having Clásico, El Clásico. Now, remember, once recently was during a time period where they couldn't show it live in the UK because it fell into that 2:45 to 5:15 slot. But generally, it's been kicked off at late night or prime time Spanish time, Central European time, which has then translated to the afternoon in the United States.
Yeah, and the next one, the return fixture, so the Barcelona-Real Madrid game, I think is in March, I think it is, but it will be in the afternoon US time, so a lot more favorable for us and beIN Sports in the US. So moving on, Kartik, listener mailbag. We got a ton of correspondence over the past month. The first one is from Ray Tavares, and he sent this in through email. He says, have you all seen the midweek Premier League games on Universo. They do a picture-in-picture to show the goals from the other games, kind of like the NBC Sports Goal Zone. And Ray, I haven't seen that. I think it's a great idea, especially for when there are a ton of matches on. But I'm going to have to check that out. That sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, I maybe check that out as soon as, whenever our next midweek fixture date is, which I think is in maybe in mid-January.
Yeah, I'm not sure. We got the FA Cup coming up. This is kind of the crazy time of the year anyway, so there's probably going to be a lot of midweek matches as the Premier League tries to catch up on missing some of these dates from the FA Cup, etc. So next up is Robert Nanali, and he sent this in through email. It's a long one, but it's a good one. It says, there's been a lot of discussion recently about how to make Major League Soccer more popular and accepted in America. One of the issues I personally came across when attempting to watch the league this season was accessibility. Prior to the start of the season, I made the conscious decision to flip a coin between the new expansion franchises and follow them. I live in Buffalo, New York, so I did not have a local team to support at the top level. By the luck of the coin, I became an Atlanta United fan. Here you go. Let's watch American soccer and support an American team. I've watched the Premier League for years since it was on Fox and have really become a fan of the league as a whole. I truly believe that the biggest reason for this is that the league is centrally located on one network and you always know where to go to find it. That is a problem I ran into immediately upon the start of the season for Major League Soccer. I'm a cord cutter, so I'm already more familiar and more comfortable than the average consumer searching for my content. I quickly found out that the Major League Soccer television contract is so fragmented and broken that it's extremely limited. It extremely limited my ability to watch the team I want to support. Soccer is a sport that is being influenced into America from the outside. And for an American league to succeed at the same level, they need to be presented in the same way. I don't think pro rel is necessary in America. And I feel even if we did have pro rel here, there would be an easy enough way to build financial protections into the system to allow second-tier teams to be stable. Major League Soccer needs to locate a single dedicated partner for its next television contract to make a one-stop network or app to access all of the games conveniently, as well as quality analysis and discussion of the teams, players, and coaches. Major League Soccer cannot operate its television contracts like the NBA and NHL do on regional networks and ever expect to expand its audience when the shining example of the sport in this country got to where it based on convenience of access. What do you think, Kartik?
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think that that's a very succinct analysis and something that the planners in MLS HQ and at Soccer United Marketing should probably understand and appreciate.
All right, next one is Mr. G, and he sent in this tweet. He says, number one, ProRail would expand the footprint of interest because it would draw in fans from lower division clubs watching to see who may be in line to drop, and vice versa, MLS fans watching lower division soccer. That's presuming D2, D3 gets improved TV deals in the process. Number two, it forces accountability at the bottom of the Major League Soccer table and therefore more interesting games at the end of the season. And then number three, it would help Major League Soccer stand out among the pack of major U.S. leagues. I firmly believe that to step beyond niche, it can't run like the other leagues here. So we're seeing a bit of a kind of a consistency in terms of some of the opinions in terms of Major League Soccer is thinking a lot like the NFL. And in order for it to succeed in the United States, it can't try to mirror those leagues. It needs to look at soccer leagues from around the world and try to focus on those, what they do rather than in what, say, the NBA or NHL or NFL does.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's room for both. I mean, I would be against the MLS mimicking the English system. I think the English system has allowed wealth to flow to the elites and speculators to flip clubs and offshore banks to really control the league in a way that hasn't happened in Germany, for instance, or hasn't happened in France yet. Obviously, there's some problems with competitiveness and that sort of thing everywhere. So I think there are some elements from American sports you should take into account, luxury taxes, salary caps, whatever, something like that, to maintain competitiveness. But I do also think that without pro rel, you just you haven't, there's no incentive really to develop players. There's no incentive for lower division investors to invest in clubs. There's no incentive for fans of lower division teams to maintain interest in the entire pyramid. I've noticed most of the people I talk to who are NASL fans or USL fans do not follow MLS and vice versa. So, it's a fragmented situation that I think demands. I think you have to have promotion and relegation. I am not someone who says, and I get into arguments with the Pro Rel Brigade on Twitter all the time in this regard. I'm not someone who says it has to be exactly like Europe, and I am someone who will say very strongly, I don't want to sound like David Kahn here, but we should not repeat the post 1992 English system. I think that then you just have right now wealth has been consolidated in the hands of a few elites at Soccer United Marketing and greedy MLS owners or some, you know, some greedy MLS owners. I don't think all of them. I think some of them have genuinely invested very generously in the sport. I see the same things happen in England, just in a different way. I'm concerned about the distance between the top six and the rest of the league. As we saw last year, it was a top seven. This season, it appears it might be a top six or seven, and a 15 final point drop or something with the rest of the league. I don't want that in the United States in the top flight. So, and I blame the free-for-all just to kind of completely open system without any kind of moral code and willingness of the FA to enable the Premier League for that. So I'm not necessarily someone who says we have to do it like we do in Europe, but we do have to have pro rel.
Yeah, Mr. G's point about making the leagues in the United States, the soccer leagues in the United States, more inclusive would, I would think, make it more likely that NASL and USL fans would probably be more likely to watch Major League Soccer.
Correct.
And, and vice versa. You mean, at least there's a dog in the race so that you would kind of watch some of the leagues, lower leagues, and see, okay, well, who's coming up? You mean, and who's, and likewise, vice versa, watching Major League Soccer to see, okay, who might go down. Right now it is very, you know, like you said, USL fans don't necessarily watch Major League Soccer and so on and so forth. Michael Subasic, through email sent, this one in. He says, I get it. You believe that promotion and relegation makes a league more interesting, and you think that Major League Soccer in America should adopt exactly the same system they use in Europe. At least it seems like that is the proposition you keep advocating for. And that, I think that's aimed at me personally, not you, Kartik. But he says, I sense no nuance or appreciation for how the North American system works and the excitement it creates for many of its fans. The major leagues have 30 or so franchises. NCAA football has over 120. And the fans see no need to create a rigid class system to divide the top 20 from the rest. You have to understand that not making the playoffs is like getting relegated for the most important part of the season. It just isn't the death sentence that relegation is in Europe. But perhaps there are problems with the way the system works in Europe. Relegated teams like my favorite, Leeds United, suffer for very long periods in obscurity. Perhaps we would be doing the world a favor by coming up with a system that has some elements of promotion and relegation while also keeping more than 20 teams in the same league. Maybe teams can be members of a local regional conference while also being a member of a tier of teams in the league that are scheduled to play against each other. Maybe a season can be broken up into two seasons per year, and a second division team can theoretically earn promotion in the first half of the season and get into the playoffs and win the league in the second half. But I think you would get a lot more sympathy for the Pro Rel project if you pitched it as an opportunity to take the best of both systems and make one that is an important, there's an improvement on what exists in Europe by selling people on the idea that there could be something better and unique that could combine the level playing field and dynamism of the North American system and sense of threat accomplishment from late season games that determine the team's tier in the next season in a pro rel system. Next up is Bill Payne, and he emailed us. He says, fairly new listener to your show and glad I've started tuning in. Very interesting discussion about Major League Soccer TV ratings and what they can do to improve. Unfortunately, even though I'm an avid soccer fan, I have to agree with Kartik that in the US, soccer is still a niche sport as far as TV viewership is concerned. I wanted to disprove Kartik, but so I started to do a brief Google search of attendance of sports I did not consider. I did consider a niche, such as the X Games and figure skating. Completely by random, I came across a table from a weekend in January 2016. I was a bit surprised and disappointed to find figure skating pretty high on the list, while Bundesliga was literally at the bottom. Even though we have a massive number of kids participating in soccer and have for some time now, this has not translated over to viewers as rapidly as we might have expected. Maybe we should take solace in the fact that viewership is more or less steady, possibly rising slightly. However, I do believe Major League Soccer and some is doing a poor job of figuring out how to appeal to the soccer fans. NBA learned it has to focus on its star players. Major League Baseball realized local TV deals was the way for them. NASCAR had it figured out for a while by promoting the competitiveness and good old boy persona, and is trying to recapture it with goofy playoff systems and public conflict between drivers. NHL is just trying to keep their core happy, which means fighting, but not too much fighting. NFL is just a behemoth and is just desperately trying to stay out of its own way, which it's struggling to do at the moment. Major League Soccer and some hasn't figured it out yet. I do think they were onto something with bringing more U.S. men's national team players back and promoting them, but the surprising results of this year have stabbed that plan right in the heart. I would suggest they do something of some of the things that have worked well for the NFL, which is consistent time slots, some sort of NFL red zone type program, and then really push fantasy soccer leagues. Kartik, what are your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I generally agree. I agree with a lot of what's been said in the last two sets of comments, both from Bill and from Michael. So, yeah, I think they're doing a really poor job. MLS, and this is the thing. There's an inconsistency, I think, in how MLS and some have viewed promotion of the sport and their league in this country, because there is no tried, tested, and proven way to hook potential viewers. And I think the other thing we're finding with the soccer fan audience is that if you try and hook one set of the soccer fandom, you alienate a completely different set of the soccer fandom.
Yeah. To me, Major League Soccer has a identity problem from the TV ratings perspective, because who is it going after? If it goes after the hardcore soccer fans, most of us are disinterested because, you mean, most of the league season is meaningless until it comes to the playoffs, unless you have a local team. If you have a local team to support, then that makes a big difference. But the country's so large that you can't have, you mean, local teams throughout the entire country. So then do you go after kind of more of the mainstream sports fan? And that hasn't worked either. So I guess they have to try and figure out what they want to be and how to portray themselves on television and take it from there. Next up is Toby Schumacher, and he sent in this tweet. He says, I've used another Lee Dixon line. So this is going back to podcasts, probably the last one or maybe a couple ago, where we talked about how Lee Dixon has these pearls of wisdom when he's commentating or co-commentating, where he'll give an example of something in a game tactically that we soccer dads and soccer moms and players and coaches can benefit from. And so Toby says, I've used another Lee Dixon line about moving forward that I think he used last year with my team. Paraphrasing, moving forward into space gives insight about your opponent, but also gives insight about your teammates. And to me, that's like poetry, because as a soccer dad with kids that play soccer, and I'm watching games every weekend and even going to practices, that says a lot. I mean, he really is out of this world in terms of co-commentating. Not only is he smart and can read the game so well, but he's funny. He's entertaining. And I really enjoy Lee Dixon. I think at the beginning, it was a fast race between Lee Dixon and Graham Lasso. They were neck and neck. But to me, in terms of this marathon, Lee Dixon is so far ahead of Graham. And Graham's really good, too. Lastly, Kartik, this is the last one in our listener mailbag. We had a lot this week, as I mentioned. Scott from McAllen, Texas, emailed us this question. He says, just wondering if you guys knew how this whole net neutrality thing got the axe will affect streaming and cord cutters in the next months. I don't know exactly. I'll give a couple of my thoughts. I think it's going to take some time to figure out exactly how this is going to impact things. It'll probably take more than a couple of months before we know. But what it appears to be is that the ISP, so say the Comcast of the world, could end up charging you more for your internet service based on the types of streaming sites that you go to. So, for example, Netflix, they could charge you more for streaming Netflix than they do currently. You know, currently, they would just give you $50 a month rate for all of your internet, and you can use that for whatever you want it to use it for. But with the net neutrality rule, they could actually charge you more for streaming Netflix. Vice versa, they could charge you more for streaming Sling TV or something like that, or YouTube. It puts a lot more power and control and money-making opportunities in the hands of the ISPs, and it's bad news. So we'll have to wait and see exactly how this plays out, but good question there. So listeners, if you do have any questions, feedback, comments, you name it, let us know. We'd love to read them out on there. You can send us an email to web@worldsoccertalk.com. You can tweet us at WSoccerTalk or reach us at facebook.com/worldsoccertalk. All right, Kartik, let's move on to our last segment of the show, and this is our featured topic of the week. And this one is an interesting one because we talk about these things from time and time again. We don't go into a lot of detail, but what we want to talk about is what we do and don't like about a soccer telecast. So obviously, this is kind of based on our opinions, and listeners, you may have different opinions too, and you might have other things, but what do you love about broadcasts and what don't you like? So I will start off with a couple and feel free to join in, Kartik. Some of the things I don't like. One is a rules expert. And we saw that with Mark Clattenburg, and that was a nice kind of breath of fresh air where he came in and talked about some controversial calls and gave his opinion. But to me, a rules expert really should be more so the commentator or the co-commentator. That person, or even the studio analyst, that person should have should be updated on all the rule changes and should be able to intelligently explain why a certain call was a foul or shouldn't have been a foul. And to me, kind of the Dr. Joe, I'm not a big fan of the Dr. Joe person or kind of that role of having a rules expert in a TV broadcast, because oftentimes Fox has done this during Gold Cup and I think Copa America, they'll go to him and ask his opinion. And sometimes it's like, it's just wasting time. It's just like, why are you going to this guy when it's something that's pretty obvious for the rest of us? We know it should have been a penalty and it wasn't. I guess from time to time, it could be helpful. But on those rare occasions where it's a really, really controversial decision, where it's like, you need someone of that level. But 99% of the time, you don't. Anyway, that's my opinion about that one. What about you, Kartik? What are some of the things you do like about broadcasts and don't?
Well, the rules expert, I think, is important if you have... I like what NBC did getting Clattenburg in to kind of give a refereeing perspective on things. Now, a rules expert, I think, chiming in on just various calls like Dr. Joe. I think Dr. Joe's on air presence has gotten much better in the 2 years he's been doing this, 2 years or so, not maybe 3 years, he's been doing this for Fox. But it still seems at many times to be kind of forced and unnecessary. It's a conversation that can be had in a much simpler way or not had at all. Mm-hmm. So I'm not big on the rules experts. I'd like to see more tactical breakdowns. You mentioned Premier League Productions does it. I need to check that out. I like what you see on UMAX football and other various YouTube type channels that take 6 or 7 minutes, break down the way Diego Simeone sets up at Atleti Madrid or a 7 minute lesson on the way Mauricio Pochettino has a high pressing for Tottenham. And you learn a lot from these very kind of graphical and interactive features that I don't think we see enough of during soccer broadcasts.
Yeah, I agree there. One of the things that I don't like either is cutting off commentators. So whether it's an FA Cup final or whether it's a Premier League match or, I mean, any soccer game, really. And it's entertaining. You've been listening to whoever the commentators are. And the final whistle goes and it's like, okay, great. I want to hear just maybe a minute or two of analysis or post-match thoughts. And mid-sentence, bloop, okay, the cutoff. And it goes straight to back to the studio and back to commercial. I'm like, oh my gosh, come on. At least give me a chance to hear the commentators kind of just sum up the game or share some of a few minutes on the pitch after the final whistle so we can see what's happening, what's the reaction between the players from the opposing teams, the managers, what are they doing, the fans. Just a pet peeve of mine in terms of watching soccer is when they cut off the commentators.
Yeah, and I think another pet peeve of mine would be when there is no proper post-game show for a soccer match. Now, we've seen in the course of the Premier League season this year, the beginning of the season, I was complaining that NBC was cutting out at the end of matches pretty quickly. Now we saw during the festive period them almost having too much airtime. There'll be one match on a midweek game, like yesterday, for instance. Well, yesterday, I think they did Goal Zone only until 5:30. But there was one time recently they've done Goal Zone until 6 Eastern time when they had one match, and it ended at 4:45. So maybe too much time. I prefer that, obviously, to my complaint about Fox more than anyone else is that there'll be a game and they cut out and there's no post-match analysis and they go on to whatever their other American sports-oriented programming is. I think EN Sports does a very good job of integrating pre-game and post-game shows into their kind of its bumper programs for their entire match coverage. My other complaint would be right now that I don't see enough original programming about the culture of soccer being created by the networks in the U.S. The obvious exception is what we talked about earlier in the show, the Joe Scarborough program, This Is Football, on NBCSN. But with that exception, there isn't enough of that being discussed and developed to complement game coverage.
That's a good point, Kartik. It's because, I mean, This Is Football, I mean, that's really focusing on the culture in the U.K., I mean, it has some scenes where you have some fans in some of the pubs in New York. But for the most part, it's there. I'd love to see that too. I mean, I'd love to see somebody, one of these networks capturing the passion and culture of soccer fans in the United States. So whether it's in Orlando, Cincinnati, or Atlanta, or I mean, Seattle, I mean, you go across the nation, there's a thriving soccer culture in this country. Which goes back to my thinking, which is that soccer is not a niche sport. But that's something I don't see and I don't feel. I know it's happening, but I don't see anyone capturing that. And I'd love to see that.
Yeah, and I'd love to see some more programs which capture the essence of football in Europe and Latin America and how it's different than American sporting culture. And kind of just go from that angle so that people can kind of appreciate and understand the nuances and the differences between sports in Europe, sports in Latin America, and sports in North America.
So speaking of that, Kartik, so one of the things I do like when watching a soccer telecast is a telecast that captures the atmosphere. So whether that's the tunnels, kind of being in the tunnels, which ESPN for the coverage of the Premier League, well, gosh, this is going back a long time ago now. It's almost 10 years ago. They started that in terms of having the cameras in the tunnels, seeing what's happening before the game kicks off. But not just that, though, too. Just overhead cams outside the stadium, seeing fans kind of streaming into the stadium, outside the ground shots, and any coverage that really pulls us into that experience, that makes us feel that we're there, or if we're not there, it makes us feel like we can see what's going on and we can anticipate what it must feel like to be at that stadium. And that's something that I just love to see when it's done well. And oftentimes it isn't, but we do see it from time to time. But that does make a huge difference in terms of improving and enhancing that soccer telecast. And Kartik, anything else? Anything else you can think of as far as things you do like or don't like in your broadcasts?
Well, I like a lot of what's in the broadcast. I mean, we talk extensively about how much we like NBC's coverage and ESPN's coverage and some of the graphics, the analysis, the more and more the use of on-site commentators, those sorts of things. And Fox has made some improvements as well, as BN, and all the Spanish language channels. But the things that I don't like and would like to see improvement, I think I've laid out already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just a few things I want to run through too as far as my list I have. You mentioned commentators at the stadium. That makes a big difference. But other thing, actually, kind of a benefit of having a commentator at a stadium, and one of the reasons that I do enjoy it, and again, John Champion does a great job at this, is really telling us what's happening off camera. And oftentimes, you can kind of tell when you have commentators that are broadcasting the game from, you mean, a studio in Los Angeles or a studio in, you know, wherever in Bristol, Connecticut, and they're watching the game on the same TV set, so same TV stream that you are. But when you have someone at the stadium who's telling you what's happening in the crowd or is giving you a sense of the atmosphere in the stadium, or if it's, I mean, getting quieter or getting noisier and just, I mean, players warming up or what's happening kind of at the bench, or if there's a, you mean, something happened in the tunnel, those types of things, that really does help in terms of those commentators being there. Speaking of being there, one of the things that I hate, Kartik, and you may disagree with me on this one, but I see no benefit whatsoever of having sideline reporters. Yes, it's nice to have somebody on the sideline, but I don't think I've ever, in my experience of watching thousands of soccer matches, ever had anything I've learned from a sideline reporter being able to tell me something about what's happening down there that's... I mean, enhanced my viewing experience of that game. To me, it just seems like a complete waste.
Injury news, maybe it's the only thing, but yeah, I tend to agree. I don't know why that trend in American sports became so prevalent of the sideline reporter. It's a bizarre thing to me. I think because there's so much dead time in those sports, which you don't have in soccer.
So speaking of dead time, one of the things I hate, Kartik, is, in a game where you're watching it and it's like, okay, this is a boring game. I mean, yes, I'm watching it. Yes, I'm interested to see what happens in this match. And then post-match, I mean, the studio team comes back and says, this was a really exciting game. Wasn't it fantastic? And I'm like, come on. Anyone who can see this game, you need objectivity. If the game's a dud, call it a dud. I mean, just call it what it is. I mean, the viewers can see through that. So don't try to justify, you mean, the reason that this broadcaster showed this game and say how wonderful it was when it,
yeah,
when it wasn't.
I think we go back to the first game of the Premier League season this year, the Arsenal-Leicester game, which was a 4-3 game where NBC, you know, just raved about the Premier League is back. Oh, what a great spectacle. You turn the channel right after Goal Zone was over that day, by the way, that Friday where the season kicked off, the ESPN FC, and you had Shaka Hislop and Craig Burley, two former Premier League players, talking about how poor the standard of football was in England based on this game. So, because they're not a rights holder, so maybe you could argue they felt like they needed to be more critical, and they already have something about Arsenal on that show that we've talked about before. But, yeah, to me, that was a clear example that where NBC was talking about, you know, all these flowery things. Rebecca Lowe was saying, oh, the Premier League is back. What entertainment, chaps, and Musto and Earl and Martino, whoever was on that day, saying the same thing, and then flipping to the other channel and they're saying the exact opposite. Oh, this shows how dire the standard of football is in England. Look at how bad the defending is. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's probably the truth is somewhere in between. It's possible that non-rights holders for leagues are more critical of leagues they don't have the coverage of, right? They don't have the rights to, than they would be otherwise. That's possible also. I'm accounting for that possibility. I think it's certainly something that's out there. There's no question about it in my mind. And I don't blame the broadcaster or the person on air for it, Chris, because they get drilled certain things in production meetings, right? They get drilled certain things. They're in a bubble. Everybody who broadcasts this sport is in a bubble to a certain extent, right? And if you're watching the Premier League 80% of the time and you're only watching La Liga, MLS, and the Bundesliga and Liga MX the other 20% of the time, maybe you have a skewed impression of how good the Premier League is, and vice versa. If you're watching the Bundesliga 80% of the time, I think a lot of the Fox commentators, and I even see them on Twitter, talking about how great the Bundesliga is, how it's the best league in the world and most competitive league in the world, blah, blah, blah. You could argue it is. I've argued it is at times, but you could also say maybe it's the fifth best league in Europe. So I think there's a lot of subjectivity based on what network has the rights to which leagues.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Another thing I am not a big fan of is broadcasts that are very predictable. So, for example, we're going into an FA Cup weekend, one that I'm not looking forward to watching, Carter, because I think that practically every single Premier League team is going to field a B team. I don't see
and a lot of Championship teams also, by the way.
I don't see any of these teams having any incentive to go ahead and play the first teams when there's so much on the line in league and other competitions. But with the FA Cup, I can predict to you, Kartik, what's going to happen. On Friday, it's Everton against Liverpool. It's on FS1. The first 30 seconds to 60 seconds of this Fox broadcast, they will have a montage. It'll open up, okay, FA Cup weekend. And then they'll have like a 2 to 3 minute video of, with somebody with a deep voice, like, FA Cup is back. You mean, like, this is David against Goliath. I mean, it's the same thing every single year, every single round. It's like, oh my gosh, come on. Like, come up with something original. Come up with something different. Don't be so predictable. And that's not just Fox either. We've seen it from NBC Sports in the past too, where they kind of got in a rut where you could almost predict what the two Robbies would be saying, and Kyle would be the guy that probably would tell you things a little bit differently or give you a different viewpoint, or and losing him for this presidential race has definitely been a hit. Has hurt NBC Sports, but they've been able to bring in some other people to kind of mix things up. But going back, it's just, I do not like predictable broadcasts. I like to see original ideas, new thoughts, different things, something that's going to mix things up. And we've seen that, I mean, for years with the UEFA Champions League coverage on Fox. We know almost by the minute exactly what's going to happen. When they do mix things up, it's good. It's a breath of fresh air.
Yeah, that one week, of course, they're midweek games. The week they had Jovan Karofsky in the studio instead of whoever he was replacing, I thought it was really good. It was a different perspective. It was a completely different point of view. And it was a guy who had played in a lot of Champions League games, which they generally don't have at the network. Mm-hmm. Or at least had been on the squad for teams that had played in a lot of Champions League games. I actually think he's played in a number of Champions League games.
Yeah.
In his career.
Yeah, he has. I mean, going on that in terms of talent, I mean, to me, hiring talent that adds value and makes you think beyond barroom conversations is something I always like to have. So whether it's, say, Roberto Martinez, or whether it's Owen Hargreaves, or it's Mark Clattenburg, or others, where you have some talent that comes in and really focuses on a particular aspect of the game and something you hadn't thought of. And it's something...
Someone who is really reporting and isn't very conventional in their reporting. So NBC brings Neil Ashton on a couple of weeks ago. The Amanda Stavely takeover, it's imminent, right? Yep. Is what we're being told in the other newspapers. Ashton comes over and comes out and says, look, I don't think Rafa Benitez is going to be very happy. This is weeks, if not months away, not days away. Rebecca Lowe is floor. I'm thinking, my goodness, I just got something out of this program that nobody else is getting here in the States or in the UK. They all think the takeover is imminent. I hope Newcastle United fans are aware of this. And guess what? Ashton was correct. This was, I think this might have been the week of December 15th games, or 14th games, right?
Right.
Yeah, 16th that he had said this. And we're 2 weeks on, 2.5 weeks on now. The takeover hasn't happened. And if you're a Newcastle fan or you're Rafa Benitez himself, you've got to be getting kind of antsy and nervous, and maybe Rafa walks. So those sorts of things are important. People say, well, why do you bring a reporter? Why do you bring a quote insider on? A lot of times they don't add value, right? They just give you things that you already know, or they're breaking news that they would break somewhere else.
Back of the papers. It's like, yeah. Okay, here's the headlines for The Sun and The Daily Mirror.
Right, correct.
It's like, come on, you can find that online if you wanted to.
But in that case, and that's not the first case in the 5 years he's been coming on NBC, in that case, Neil Ashton broke some very, very important news.
Yeah.
And I thought it was really timely. And he's been kind of on the money on managerial appointments too, except for the one being Swansea, where he came on the air and admitted he had actually had a conversation with Caraval the previous night about the end of his tenure at Sheffield Wednesday for a story he was putting in the paper the next day, and Swansea never came up. And then the next morning he took the Swansea job, but. That, I think, is something that adds value to a broadcast.
Yep.
But you have to have the right guy, because 90% of the reporters out there are probably just going to repeat things that are on the back pages or have already been reported.
Yeah. Neil Ashton is such a trustworthy news reporter and does bring in some great insight. Another person I would add to that list is Gab McCarty.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
I mean, somebody that really understands the game and gives some really... really excellent opinions and also insight in terms of what's happening inside some of these clubs.
Marcotti's able to do both, where he can be a commentator. I think they bring him on ESPN FC a lot for analysis. I mean, he's on just about every day, but they bring him on for a lot of analysis as well as breaking news. So he's, I think he's got a very unique role, a very unique niche, and also, obviously is based in Britain and it's close to Chelsea, but also is Italian, is also American. So I think he may be a bit of a one-off. Yeah, absolutely. Marcotti adds so much value to anything he's on.
So one of the things we haven't heard in a while, but we have heard from time to time, is it just a really intelligent discussion about a topic. And I mean, I think of Carlo Martino in many ways as far as having been kind of a leader in this, bringing up a topic that he's been thinking about all week, and they bring it up on the Saturday morning, and then the two Robbies and him and Rebecca go into it in more detail. But that's something that I really appreciate, whether it's no matter what network it is, but a really intelligent discussion about it could be a serious topic, but something that is well thought out, has some really good opinions, has some really good research and analysis, and isn't a manufactured debate, isn't a debate about something where you can tell that they rehearsed it beforehand and it's a little bit scripted. You can tell that it's fake, but this is something that's really intelligent and is really, for a TV viewer, you just want to sit back and just listen and absorb the information and be informed. And that's something that we haven't seen in a while, at least I haven't. But when it does happen, it just makes for such a great soccer telecast. Another thing, Kartik, I do not like is biased analysis. And we've talked about this from when it's USA coverage, and it seems to be extremely biased in the favor of the U.S. men's national team. But it doesn't have to be that. Sometimes it can be on a club-specific basis. But I like to see, I want to see favoritism. I just want to see people call it the way that they see it, to be objective, to give their insight, whether it's, critiquing positively or negatively, but not being biased, just calling it the way that they see it. I mean, sometimes it's difficult when it's a controversial decision. But we saw that a few weeks ago, too, with even Phil Neville, where he went the opposite way. I mean, a former Everton player.
Overcompensating, maybe.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and I'm like, Phil, like, what's happening? Like, you're going the other way. Like, it was a foul, the Wayne Rooney foul, I guess it was. And he was saying, like, there was no contact at all whatsoever. I'm like, come on. There was contact, not much, but anyway. But anyway, for me, I just like to see analysis and, analysis that is unbiased as much as
possible. That's especially tough with the U.S. On Fox, because, they're again, that bubble and that echo chamber has gotten so loud. And I have said this and gotten a lot of criticism for this. I'll say it again here. I think the U.S. missing the World Cup had – there were several factors that contributed. I think one of the factors that absolutely contributed was the media bubble and the constant positivity coming from the media. There are exceptions. I think there are really good writers. I'll single one out, Jeff Carlisle, who also comes on the ESPN FC show from time to time, is a guy that at various points in this qualifying cycle sounded the alarm that no one else wanted to hear, quite frankly, who covered the national team, particularly on television. So, I think they had their own responsibility in the debacle. So if you're going to be a cheerleader, you're going to be a fan, at least cheerlead and be a fan in a way that helps the thing you're cheerleading for, rather than actually helps carpoon it.
All right, two more from me, Kartik. The next one up is no bait and switching on the kickoff times. So yeah. This is a pet peeve of mine and a lot of people, and it's getting old. Is a lot of the games, whether it's for the U.S. men's national team or women's team or Major League Soccer broadcast, but they'll advertise the kickoff time, say at 7:30 p.m. You tune at 7:30 p.m. The game doesn't kick off till 8:15 or 8:05 or whatever it is. And it's a bait and switch because you get people tuning in hoping that to watch the kickoff, and then they're sitting through 20 minutes or 30 minutes or 45 minutes of pregame coverage that they didn't want to watch.
Yeah, I'll give you the perspective from the other side on this, and I tend to agree with you. But as someone who worked in a league in ASL, we did it all the time. We would advertise a 7:30 kickoff, get people hooked on the broadcast, whether it was the local broadcast, the YouTube broadcast, whatever, Ustream in those days, or an actual television broadcast, and not kick off till 7:47 and never advertise that any time at any point, but internally had that kickoff time, to the point where I think league officials began getting upset with teams who would do that. So it's very different than it is in Europe, where if a match is advertised to kick off at 3 p.m. British Standard Time, it is kicking off at 3 p.m. British Standard Time.
Yeah.
This is absolutely a case. So I agree with you. It's a pet peeve of mine also, and I've lived it. And the deceit has been premeditated. It's not just an accident.
Yeah, short term, I can see the benefits in terms of juicing up the numbers and getting more people in to watch the match early, so that by the time the kickoff time, it's the highest number possible. Long term, it's a failed plan because just piss people off, and they're going to be like, forget about it, or it's just it's a bait and switch. All right. Lastly, Kartik, the last one from my side is focus on the game, not on filling dead air. And we can probably think of a few commentators that have this in their kind of ammunition. But to me, it's like, oftentimes when we're watching a match, it sounds like it's a chat show, that the match is just a something that's happening on the side that's not the most important thing. And you have two guys talking back and forth about what's happening. And, hey, did you hear about that story that happened yesterday with some transfer story or expansion or whatever it is. Meanwhile, there's a game being played in front of you. You should be commentating on the game with the players and what's happening on the pitch. And I've seen this across the board. I've seen this through, one memorable one was La Liga match, where there was a game, this is going back many, many years, but it was Ray Hudson and Phil Shane. And for the first 4 to 5 minutes of the game, they were talking about building up the game and talking about who's playing who, and the match is going on. Meanwhile, I think it might've been Barcelona. Barcelona went on this like 34 pass run. I was counting the passes and kind of tuning out the commentators, just watching this marvel of how many passes they had. And they scored a goal, I think, in maybe the fourth minute or something like this. And I was like, and these guys completely missed it because they're so focused on talking about the game and what's on stake, what's at stake, and et cetera. And it's not being sports. Go down the list. I think every broadcaster is guilty of this to some extent, some more than others. But I'm tuning in to watch a soccer game. I want to know what's happening on the pitch. Give me insight on the pitch, not what's happening off the pitch. So, Kartik, you agree with me on that one?
In the defense of the co-commentators and the commentators that are in those games, they often don't get an opportunity to talk about other soccer-related news that relates to the two teams playing, but maybe not directly to what's in front of their eyes at that very moment during the course of the week or on the broadcast, because they're not bringing Arlo White and Lee Dixon on the NBC studio to talk about what's going on with the Manchester City Watford game while they're broadcasting Liverpool versus Everton, and they want to interject something. So I think it goes both ways. It's also the way you use your personnel to some extent.
Yeah, I see that too, definitely too, because it's something that if a broadcaster doesn't have like a new show or doesn't have a lot of time for kind of analysis pre-match and just goes into the game cold, that sometimes that you have to kind of have that for some viewers that may not know the backstory. But yeah, it's just a pet peeve of mine in terms of what I've been watching. I mean, thousands of games, and when it does happen, I'm like, oh, come on, please. And sometimes we've seen that too, where there's certain commentators that will just, again, throughout the entire match, even with a pre-match, even with kind of a new show, they're still just talking about other things that are happening. And I think Ian Dark, to a certain extent, is guilty of this too, especially when it's a lull in the game and he's talking about transfers and gossip and things that you would read in the Sun or the Mirror. We don't get to hear him as much anymore, but when he does come on, that especially if it's a Premier League game, that's often, I mean, that's this thing that he likes. And sometimes it can be refreshing once in a while, but not all the time. All right, Kartik, so where can listeners find you on the internet if they want to read up on some of your latest stories or tweets, or to find out when you'll be on different podcasts?
KKFLA737 on Twitter, and then find me at worldsoccertalk.com.
All right, guys. Well, thank you so much for listening to our first episode of 2018. You can get a new episode of the World Soccer Talk podcast every Thursday. Every episode is released on SoundCloud, YouTube, Stitcher, iTunes, TuneIn, Audioboom, and worldsoccertalk.com. If you like the show, share it with your friends on social media and give us a review on iTunes. We'd greatly appreciate it. And Kartik, what should they do?
Enjoy your football.